From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Welcome to the end of our special series about truth, done in collaboration with the nonprofit journalism group, TheConversation.com. This week, we've been exploring the concept of truth through some of its many facets. And on Monday, we talked about how some ancient cultures define truth. I asked classic scholar Joel Christensen, what is the Greek word for truth?
What is fascinating is that there's not just one. All right, so let's start out with one that's probably the most famous, and that's aletheia. So aletheia literally means something more like the unforgettable. So something that cannot be forgotten or must always be remembered.
Must always be remembered. So truth, in part, dwells in the brain. That was the focus of our second conversation, where we looked at the neuroscience behind how we perceive the truth. Adrian Barden said, in certain ways, our brains aren't really built to accept the truth.
We're not reasoning machines. We're not computers that just calculate and spit out the right results. We're able to adapt our beliefs to our situation, our environment, our needs. And so what we call reasoning, and what even in our own minds, when we think we're reasoning, we're often really rationalizing. We're acting more like lawyers trying to win a case than like, you know, scientists trying to reach the truth.
But it's that capability to rationalize instead of always reason, the fact that we're social and emotional animals. I got to get this in there. More Kirk than Spock. Well, that makes us human beings both so successful as groups, but also terribly susceptible to manipulation. Yesterday, we looked at how authoritarians have managed to manipulate and distort truth in the name of power. We spoke to Razak al-Sahidi. He was born and raised in Iraq under the oppressive rule of Saddam Hussein.
You know, the irony is, if you have too little freedom, you cannot know the truth. But if you have too much, you are spoiled and you don't value it as much as you would if it was more rare.
Well, that brings us to today and these questions. Is Razak right? Do we not value truth as much as we should? Are we living in a post-truth nation? And what are the implications of that for our democracy? So this hour on Point, post-truth. And joining us in the studio to help us explore this idea is Lee McIntyre. He's a research fellow at Boston University's Center for Philosophy and the History of Science and author of multiple books, include Respecting Truth, Willful Ignorance in the Internet Age, and Post-Truth. He's also written several articles for TheConversation.com. They're linked at our website, onpointradio.org. Lee, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when we say post-truth, what do you think that means?
Okay. It's easy to have a misconception about what post-truth means. And to say that we live in a post-truth era doesn't mean that truth doesn't matter anymore or that no one cares about truth. It means that we live in an era where truth is at risk, where we're in danger of losing sight of what truth means. In my book, I define truth as post-truth as the political subordination of reality. So I think of post-truth as a tactic that's used by authoritarians and their wannabes to control the flow of information so that they can then control the populace. It's intended not just to corrupt our belief in some specific thing that's true, but really to undermine the idea that we can know truth outside a political context.
Mm-hmm. So this political subordination of reality, I really like the potency of that phrase. But one of the potential lessons that I feel we're drawing from this week is it has forever been thus. Right? So, in part because of how our brains are built, because how our societies operate, we've just had multiple examples of how that subordination occurs. Sometimes willingly, actually, sometimes human beings willingly do that, other times through force and coercion. So, I mean, is there anything uniquely different about that happening in the United States this time around versus, you know, how yesterday we talked about the Soviets and the Iraqis, the 1930s Germany. Name your example. Yeah. What's different now?
It's a great question because The roots of this have been around forever. Politicians have lied. There have been enormous lies, enormous political subordination of reality, if you will, to the Holocaust, American slavery. I mean, you just go back in history, it's mm-hmm. always existed. What's different now, and I think the reason that the Oxford Dictionary's named post-truth their word of the year in 2016, is that this seems new in the following sense. Extreme political partisanship married to the social media, married yeah. to how quickly misinformation and disinformation can get out there, I think makes this a sort of a unique challenge of our time. It's sort of a pandemic, if you will, of disinformation and misinformation that is new. So maybe the tendencies, the roots that I explore in the book of post-truth have been there for a long time, but we're now facing something that I think is a unique threat, and it's new at least in the American experiment, here we are.
So tell me more about some of the roots that you think of post-truth that you do explore in the book.
Okay. Yeah. So I start the book by saying that one of the main roots of post-truth is 70 years of science denial. Mm-hmm. Science denial, again, has probably been around as long as science. But in the modern era, it really started with the cigarette companies in the 1950s, which were freaked out because there was a study that was going to be published showing that there was a link between cigarette smoking and cancer. And what they did was they hired a public relations expert, and they all came together and decided that they were going to fight the science. So they were manufacturing doubt. And there's a terrific book on this by Naomi Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt. Mm-hmm. And that became the blueprint for science denial. And what happened is, I think that people learned, if you can deny the truth about cigarette smoking and cancer, about climate change, about evolution, about flat earth, about anything you want, then you can deny the truth about how many people are at an inauguration, or whether the murder rate is going up or down, or whether Hurricane Dorian was or was not headed toward Alabama. It's all part of the same thing. There are other chapters on cognitive bias, yeah. the decline of traditional media, the rise of social media, and then postmodernism, which I think all of these things come together and create this perfect storm, if you will, for post-truth that we've seen over the last several years.
Well, we are in part four, the final part of our series about truth. And today we're asking if the United States is a post-truth society and what that means for our democracy, for this country, for us as citizens and residents of America. Now, Lee, you mentioned postmodernism, and that's yes. actually something that we haven't talked about this week so far. We've definitely touched on social media, the velocity of information, neuroscience, etc. Postmodernism, or the idea of, I guess, well, first of all, why do you think that that's part of this post-truth story? Here.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm not the only person who thinks this, yeah. But I've got to say that most of my hate mail comes from postmodernists who are upset about this. Postmodernism is a view that came out of literary criticism in the 1970s and 80s, which was really based on Derrida and a few other people's ideas that there was really no such thing as objective truth,
right.
that you could not read a text, for instance, and defer to the author about what the actual meaning was, that the real meaning was constructed in this dialogue between the reader and the text. So there was no one actual truth. And then another important idea in postmodernism was Foucault's idea that given the fact that there was really no such thing as objective truth, any claim to truth was really a power play. It was really a kind of a bullying tactic. And what happened is all of this reached a head in the 90s during something called the Science Wars, where not the postmodernists but some people who admired them came together and started to criticize the idea that even natural science could discover objective reality and that it was shot through with politics, which drove natural scientists crazy. And I'm a philosopher of science. I mean, I'm on the side of the natural scientists here because I do think that you can discover truth. And my book is about how to stand up for that. And I don't think that the postmodernists intended this, but what happened next is that the right wing co-opted some of their tactics and started to use them for the purposes that we see.
Well, we heard at the very, very beginning of the hour, we used those quotes from Rudy Giuliani, where he said, truth isn't truth. It's just his truth or her truth, not the truth. I mean, but isn't there something to that, though? Because I take your point about objective reality, especially in the scientific context. But when we're talking about truth, one of the threads that's been woven through this week is that really what we're talking about is, to a certain degree, our perception of those objective realities. And perhaps because if it's those perceptions that really matter in the end when it comes to how we live in societies, then there must be something to the idea that therefore there is no objective truth.
Well, this I'm a philosopher. This all goes back to Plato's cave and the idea of whether you can know objective reality. Can you see the sun or can you only see the reflections of the shadows in the cave? So, I mean, this problem has really been around for a long time. And, I know all these debates. I nonetheless, in my book, Post-Truth, stand up for the idea that that truth matters and that, it's an important thing to uphold, not just in the natural sciences, but elsewhere. Because I think that no matter how much Rudy Giuliani talks about truth not being truth and Kellyanne Conway talking about alternative facts, there are real facts in the world. Coronavirus is either going to spread or it's not. We're either going to be able to contain it or it's not. And I don't care what anybody's narrative is on this. I don't care what they feel or what their political point of view might be. Facts are facts. And even if it's difficult for us to know them, they're nonetheless real. And I think that that's something that has really gotten lost in our politics of the last 3 years, where people think of everything as a matter of opinion. And that's the danger, right? That's the danger of succumbing to, I think, Foucault's idea, which is that post-truth is really not about knowledge. It's about power. Mm-hmm. And it's about Trump being able to want to say that something is true, even when it's not true, because it's a way of dominating someone's reality.
Well, we're going to explore more about the political implications and, again, the small d democratic implications for our society if we're living in a post-truth world. We'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is part four of our special series about truth that we've been producing in collaboration with the nonprofit journalism group, TheConversation.com. And today we've arrived at the point where we're discussing whether or not the United States is currently a post-truth society and the implications of that for our democracy. I'm joined today by Lee McIntyre. He's a research fellow at Boston University's Center for Philosophy and the History of Science, author of Respecting Truth, Willful Ignorance in the Internet Age, and also author of Post-Truth as well. Now, so Lee, let's focus and dig right down into the impact that President Trump is having on this conversation, on this national conversation about truth. I will explore sort of the broader political implications too, because I don't think it's uniquely focused on President Trump, although he is a huge factor in this. And we've collected some tape of things that the president has said when he has been confronted with real-time fact-checking, essentially. And I wanted to play a bunch of little cuts here because I think they sort of reveal something about his political approach, maybe his fundamental approach, and what it says about politics today, politics and truth. So first of all, let's start in February of 2017 when President Trump made this false claim about his November 2016 victory.
I guess it was the biggest Electoral College win since Ronald Reagan.
Well, in fact, it was not. There are Democratic and Republican presidents who've won more Electoral College votes than President Trump did in November 2016. And in fact, later in that very same press conference, NBC's Peter Alexander presented Mr. Trump with the facts.
You said today that you had the biggest electoral margin since Ronald Reagan with 304 or 306 electoral votes. In fact, President Obama got 365.
Well, I'm talking about Republican.
President Obama, 332, yeah. And George H.W. Bush, 426 when he won as president. So why should Americans trust?
Well, no, I was given that information. I don't know. I was just given. We had a very, very big margin.
I guess my question is, why should Americans trust you when you accuse the information they receive of being fake when you're providing information?
Well, I don't know. I was given that information. I've seen that information around. But it was a very substantial victory. Do you agree with that?
You're the president.
Lee McIntyre. The president does a couple of interesting things there. First of all, he just backs away from the responsibility around the information that he presented. Then he also says, well, I've seen it around. And then finally he says, well, it was still a major victory, wasn't it? And he forces Peter Alexander into a corner to acknowledge, well, yeah, you won, so that's major. But that's not even actually the fact that was initially at dispute here. You know, what do you hear in how the president handled this moment?
Well, I think that's a good example. I think it's a typical example of what post-truth means. He's not concerned with the facts. He's concerned with the political interpretation of the facts. And so he'll back off when he has to. But actually, that's quite rare. That clip that you played for him to say, well, I don't know if really, I was given that information. Normally what he does is he doubles down on it. I'm sure you've got other examples. But it raises this really interesting question in my mind. Why would somebody lie about something when they're so easily refuted? I mean, when we've got tape, when the statistics exist, when he knows that it's not true, but he says it anyway.
Because exposure to the lie doesn't matter.
Exactly. That's exactly the point of post-truth. The point of post-truth is not to convince you that something is true. It's to dominate your reality such that you've got no choice but to deal with the fact that he's going to say it and move on. He's not accountable. I can give you a better example if you like.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the example that I think is the kind of the purest example of post-truth in recent years is the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. So Trump had been scheduled to do a political rally that evening. And then when the shooting happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue, it was, it's a terrible tragedy. And the question came up, well, was he going to cancel his rallies? And he said no, in fact, because after all, the New York Stock Exchange was open the day after 9/11.
Which it was not.
It was not. It was 6 days after 9/11. But here's the point. When it was pointed out to Trump that that was incorrect, he shrugged it off. Because it didn't matter, and he held the rallies anyway. And so the point is, even though he was refuted, the lie had served its political purpose, and that was more important than the fact. The fact was not important. The political purpose is what was important. He got to hold the rally, even though his fact was wrong.
So I want to actually play a couple of other moments that support this, Lee, because I think the president, when he responds to these moments, he also sheds light on something else about how this post-truth moment works in America right now. So first of all, let's just listen back to one of the claims that the president, when he was a candidate, made very, very frequently during the 2016 campaign. Here it is.
We're going to reduce taxes tremendously. Because we have the highest tax rate anywhere in the world.
We're actually the highest taxed major country anywhere in the world by far.
We're the highest taxed nation in the developed world. Highest taxed nation in the world.
That little montage courtesy of MSNBC. Now, you heard the president saying that highest tax rate overall, that's not true. He doesn't actually specify what kinds of taxes. And then in October of 2017, in the run-up to the passage of the GOP tax cut, which went through in December of 2017, reporter Mike Sachs, who was then working for Scripps Howard News Service, he actually asked the president why he insisted on making this false claim. And here's what happened.
Now, you've repeatedly said that we're the highest taxed nation in the world. When that's been seen as objectively false, how, with the credibility you need to pass tax reform, why do you
say it? Some people say it differently, and they'll say we're the highest developed nation taxed in the world.
Then why don't you say it that way?
Because a lot of people know exactly what I'm talking about, and in many cases, they think I'm right when I say the highest. As far as I'm concerned, I think we're really essentially the highest. But if you'd like to add the developed nation, you can say that too. But a lot of people agree that the way I'm saying it is exactly correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. Yep.
So again, just to provide the facts, until the GOP tax cut in December of 2017, the U.S. ranked near the top of developed countries only with regards to the statutory corporate tax rate. For personal income tax rates, those highest marginal income tax rates, the U.S. has amongst the lowest marginal tax rates there in comparison with developed countries. One more clip here just to use as an example, because the president has made it perfectly clear that for him, if people believe what he says, regardless of the facts, then that is what matters. So listen to this January 2017 exchange between David Muir of ABC News and the president.
You know what's important? Millions of people agree with me when I say that. If you would have looked on one of the other networks and all of the people that were calling in, they're saying, we agree with Mr. Trump, we agree. They're very smart people.
Do you think that talking about millions of illegal votes is dangerous to this country?
No, not at all.
Presenting the
evidence?
Not
at all, because many people feel the same way that I do.
That's the president in January 2017. So Lee McIntyre, I think there it is, right? First of all, the president says, well, you know, people out there, they know what I'm talking about because they're feeling it. And that is the basis upon which what I'm saying is true. And he actually, that David Muir clip, he also says there's absolutely nothing dangerous about that.
Yeah, those are kind of chilling, those sorts of statements. And I mean, it's important to realize that Trump isn't the only person who's doing this. But you're right to point out the difference between him saying that he is right versus that people think that he's right.
Or feel it.
Or feeling it, because it's sort of a kind of a magical thinking or a deferring to consensus. There's an example I use in the book, it's too long to read, of Newt Gingrich in a conversation with Allison Camerota on CNN about whether or not the murder rate is going up or down, which was a claim that Trump had made in February of the election year. And it's chilling because it's the same kind of example of, well, people feel that the murder rate's going up, but it's not. Here, I think, is the point. Reality can give a hard correction to that sort of thing. And Trump can say that it doesn't matter or that millions of people agree with him. But what happens now when he's making the claim that coronavirus is well contained or that we've got enough kits or that there's going to be a vaccine and there's not? My mind is always drawn back to the example of the Challenger disaster in the 1980s when they brought a commission together to examine what went wrong of this, you know, political motivation to get the Challenger up in the sky, even though it was not ready. It was not supposed to be launched that day. And Richard Feynman, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, was on the commission that investigated. And here's what he said. For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled. Well, so what's going to happen when Trump lies about something that isn't one of the things that you brought up, or something where he can just bowl ahead, but where it's something where lives are at risk?
Yeah.
I mean, we've already had this through with the hurricane in Puerto Rico. There can be a hard correction from reality coming on something like this.
It must be said, though, that the president isn't the cause. He's a symptom of something deeper, right?
I agree. And I said in my book that I don't think that Trump caused post-truth. I think he's the result. I think that these forces have been building for many decades. And we see it all around the world.
Can we see it spreading across our politics here, just beyond the circle of the president or the Republican Party?
I hope not, but I'm afraid that there are some instances in which people have seen that, well, I can lie and not apologize or not be accountable and just move ahead.
If we're not already seeing that, I feel it's absolutely inevitable.
Yeah. And the worry that I have is if that becomes so, it's pretty hard to put that genie back in the bottle once it's out. And if that just becomes a pervasive part of our politics, left and right, no matter what we believe, that survives this presidency, I think we're in real trouble.
Well, let's bring in another voice into this conversation to talk about exactly that. Christopher Beam joins us from State College, Pennsylvania. He's assistant research professor and managing director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and co-host of the podcast Democracy Works, author of The Necessity of Politics and of Democratic Humility. Christopher Beam, welcome to you.
Thank you. I appreciate the time to be here.
So do you think that our democracy is currently sort of wading through a post-truth moment?
I can't think of a single thing that Lee McIntyre has said that I disagree with. So it may be a pretty boring conversation. But yeah, I do. I think when you have a political culture in which the head of state, the president, has made 16,000 false and misleading statements, it makes it just fundamentally more difficult to sustain a democracy.
So
why is that?
I've heard this said over and over again, and I suppose I'm reaching the point where I just think, what should we do? What can we do about it? Because again, to this idea that the president is a symptom of something deeper in America, in the world even, is there any way to sort of to turn the tide on it?
Well, you know, democracy is hard. It requires things of you that are unnatural. It requires you to be passionate and yet temperate. It requires you to accept the idea that this person with whom you disagree vehemently has as much right to their opinion and as much right to express it as you do. And the other thing it requires of you is a commitment to reflect your perspectives accurately, honestly. And it means hearing things or being concerned about the world as it is rather than the world as you want it to be. Mm-hmm. None of these things are easy. And the only thing I can tell you is that in a democracy, we are all responsible. We are all sovereign, right?
Yeah.
It's not any one person's job to run it. It's all of ours. And so that means we all just have to commit to some things that are hard, and the truth is hard.
Yeah.
Our biases push us in directions that make us disinclined to listen to things we don't agree with, the things we don't like, and so it's only through a kind of personal commitment to the truth that any of this can be undone.
Yeah.
And there's so many things pushing us the other way right now.
You know, we've always had there's that famous phrase of you're entitled to your opinion but not your own set of facts.
Right.
That's been around for a while, but I think one of the concerning things about right now is people actually, when we think about truth, people actually do feel like their set of facts are the true ones. I mean, their set of facts, quote unquote, are the true ones. That there isn't even the willingness to agree to what are the facts, Christopher?
Well, or even is objectivity even a goal? Right? Is it possible? And B, is it something that is worth striving for? Is it worth us demanding it of ourselves? And in a political climate in which, you know, being false or being, I guess better to say it, being indifferent to the truth has become a very successful political strategy, not just here but throughout the world. You know, politicians are going to follow that, are going to see that that is successful and behave accordingly. And so it is an uphill battle right now. There's no two ways about it. But that doesn't mean that we can sustain a democracy without those commitments.
Right. I would say that, of course, it's worth demanding of ourselves, right? Because to exactly what you said, Christopher, without it, how can we have any sense of togetherness, right? Of being compatriots with each other under the umbrella of these United States?
Well, how can we have an argument? I mean, if there is no, you know, commitment to the idea that there is this reality out there that we are all striving to understand and that we're striving to, you know, engage in terms of policy and other decisions, if we don't start with those kind of commitments, then argument is a waste of time. It's genuinely, completely a waste of time. And so if argument is a waste of time, then democracy is a waste of time. And it becomes all that's left in to take over that vacuum is power. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm firmly convinced that our democracy is at stake when we're talking about a post-truth world.
I think that's right, but I think that there is something a little more optimistic we can say about what we can do from here, because I think that your question about what can we do about this is a good one, but I think that there are some answers, and I think that they come from us, from science, and I'm ready to talk about that, maybe leave us on a little bit more optimistic note if you like.
I'm always for some optimism, factual optimism. A little later in the show, we will get to those solutions, but we've got to take a quick break now. This is part four of our special series on truth. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is part four of our special series about truth. And today we're asking if we're living in a post-truth world, a post-truth nation. And if so, what are the implications for that for our democracy? And what can we do as residents and citizens of this country to undo the effects of post-truth? I'm joined today by Lee McIntyre. He's a research fellow at Boston University Center for Philosophy and the History of Science, author of Respecting Truth and Post-Truth as well. And Lee, in a couple of minutes, I promise I'll let you give us those sure. solutions because I really want to hear them. But I'm also joined by Christopher Beam. He's assistant research professor and managing director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and co-host of the podcast Democracy Works. Both my guests today have written extensively for TheConversation.com. That's the nonprofit journalism group that we are collaborating with on this series. Now, Christopher, one thing I wanted to just, sort of restate is that our current president, President Trump, is rather unique, I would say, in terms of the frequency, the velocity, the volume of the number of misleading statements that he has made in a very short period of time. That, I think that's rather new in U.S. history. But the idea that presidents or politicians before haven't said things that aren't true is just obviously we don't accept that either. I'm thinking about President Clinton very much like challenging your depends on what your definition of is.
Sure.
You go back even further. We were going to explore earlier this week President Johnson just flat out lying about the Vietnam War. So it has happened a lot before. But what I wanted to know from you, Christopher, is are we particularly vulnerable right now because what is also failing in this post-truth democracy of ours are the very institutions of democracy that in the past most of the time operated to keep that subordination of truth, as Lee was saying earlier, in check.
So which institutions are you referring to specifically?
Well, Clinton said depends on what is. In the context of an impeachment, right, and a trial.
Right.
And granted, we just went through an impeachment as well.
with the president. We had other politicians in previous generations willing to speak out and challenge presidents or their fellow politicians, things like that, sort of the institution of government.
Well, look, I mean, you're right that politicians always have a problematic relationship with the truth. And I mean, you know, I can go back to Cicero, you know, never was a government that was not composed of liars, malefactors and thieves. Uh-huh. And that was 2000 years ago. Right. So none of this is new. And, you know, I always say, you know, Profiles in Courage is a very, very thin book. You know, it is unusual for a politician to go against the tide of partisan advantage and self-interest. So it is, you know, if you're looking for politicians to stand up to the tide, that's not likely to happen.
Right.
There are other ways of counter. There are other sources of countervailing power in any society that you need to look to. You know, and what an authoritarian will do is try to undermine those sources of countervailing power. So when you say things like the media is the enemy of the people, you are undermining the role of the press in holding you accountable and holding you, the president, accountable. You're undermining the power that comes from that position.
Well, you know, Lee, let me bring you back in here, because when we did our hour about the neuroscience of how the brain perceives truth, one of the lessons I drew from that is we are far more likely to accept correction about our misperceptions if it's coming from members of our own self-identified groups, right? And that absolutely applies in politics, too. I think we can point to a number of examples of how turning points have happened when someone from within one's own party stands up and says, no, what you're not saying is true. But that is one of the things that I think we see far less of, if not at all anymore these days, members of the same political identity willing to hold each other to account.
I think you're right about that. In fact, I noted the other day when I was listening to the program, I forget who it was who said that identity influences belief. It's not just evidence. It's not just facts. It's what we want to believe, which team we're on, and that we're more likely to believe something when it's from somebody on our team. I think that that's an important part of the solution for how we get out of this, because we're not talking to each other anymore. I can't remember the last time I saw a speech in Congress that there wasn't empty chairs behind the speaker. I mean, they're literally all across the street dialing for dollars while one of their colleagues is speaking. They're not engaging. They're not speaking. We're polarized. We're on our own silos of information and not talking to each other. And I think that actually the part of the solution, I don't know if you're ready to talk about this yet, but part of the solution to this is to begin to engage with one another, mm-hmm. because the scientific literature has shown that the way that people begin to change their mind on topics having to do with science denial is through personal engagement,
right.
Not just sharing facts and evidence, but getting those facts and evidence from somebody that you trust, somebody that you've had a personal relationship built with. But if we're not building the relationship, how do we expect the information to
get
across?
We've got hashtags. Come on.
Yeah. That's the worst way to get information across.
That was very tongue-in-cheek, right. Actually. Well, you know what? We're going to hear more about solutions here in a minute. But let's go to our callers. Let's go to Kenya, who's calling from Miami. Kenya, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me. I was calling mostly as a Cuban immigrant. I just wanted to point out that truth can be delivered in a way that, although it's truthful, if it's not rendered to encompass the full idea that was initially being targeted, it can be manipulated to almost represent a particular political view. In a communist country, political propaganda brainwashed generations after generations. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about building trust with people that give us information, I think a free and balanced press is pivotal in us developing that trust. So when we're listening to a press that is skewing information in one direction or another, it renders that trust almost it is something you can't achieve, because we're not really sure who to trust, whether the information is coming from a good place or to provide a particular political goal.
Well, Kenya, thank you so much for that call and for your insight there as well. Let's piggyback off what Kenya said and go to Dean, who's calling from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the perfect storm that we seem to be in right now. But we have always had propaganda. You mentioned Johnson. We know about the Pentagon Papers. Mm-hmm. We've always had marketing, the cigarette companies. We've talked about that. We have not always had the democratization of information that we have now. When you look at how information through press and publishing and the publishing industry and traditional media was vetted versus the complete abdication of editorial responsibility that Facebook has done, we're in uncharted territory, and these things combined really serve to dilute and undermine and fragment truth. I think when we add to this technology and the potential for deep fakes, then the storm becomes a tempest, I don't know where we go from there. I will say one other thing. You know, we're talking about how democracy gets undermined here. Our democracy has already been undermined by consumer culture. We no longer share commonly held values and principles as a nation. What we share, what our democracy is democratic access to consumer goods. Mm. Right? That's what our democracy is. So in some ways, you know, we're already there. Our democracy has already been undermined.
Wow. Well, Dean, thank you so much for your call. Lee McIntyre, you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the philosopher Jason Stanley said that in his work, How Propaganda Works, the point of propaganda is not to convince you, it's to show you who's boss. So I think back to your program yesterday with Mr. Al-Saidi. Mm-hmm. If there's just one channel, then, you know, they can say whatever they want and you don't know what's true, what's false, but maybe you're suspicious, you're cynical. It sounded like he was. But what do you do when there are many, many, many channels and, you know, you're a wannabe authoritarian and you want to undermine the, you know, what's happening? Then you flood the market with disinformation. You know, mm-hmm. then the thing is to undermine the free press, provide, as I said before, a counter narrative, and just make people cynical to the point that you can ever even know the truth. I think that's the insidious nature of post-truth, because it causes us to think that there is no such thing as truth. It's not just to make us believe some particular false thing, but to think, you know, I can't really know what's true outside a political context.
Christopher, go ahead.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, there's this interesting distinction between Soviet propaganda and new Russian propaganda. And Soviet propaganda was normally built around a lie, which is to say that it had some kernel of truth around which the lie was presented, right? So when Soviets said that the CIA caused AIDS, they referenced the fact that the CIA had done some biomedical experiments, right? Now, what you have, the RAND Corporation called it the fire hose of falsehood. And there are just so many competing claims, competing narratives about, well, this might have happened, or this might have happened, or this might have happened. And we don't know. We can't know. And so what happens when you hear that is that people just kind of give up. They just kind of say, how am I supposed to evaluate all this? How am I supposed to find my feet in all this? And so, and that's the objective. That's the objective, is to just make it impossible for you to find even a way out into the truth.
Flooding the zone, really. Look, we have 5 minutes left, and I actually want to end this series on a note of more than just hopefulness, but practicality in terms of how we live, how we can succeed as individuals and as a nation in this post-truth world. So, Christopher, let me just ask you. Our last caller made the point about this, the extreme fragmentation of information. Mm-hmm. I would even call it like the atomization of information. And that is a fact of our lives right now.
Right.
But there's this funny tension in American-style democracy that while we have to not just recognize but even celebrate individuals and our individual perceptions and opinions, et cetera. For our democracy to work, it also requires a certain amount of cohesion between all of us.
Right.
That tension has always been there. So how do we make it work now?
Well, I actually, listen to a lot of my students as the same thing. And I did a podcast where I said one of the things that you need, or not a podcast, a TED Talk. One of the things we need to do is to join something. Not political, but just anything that brings people together in service of some common interest, some common objective. So I said, listen, and if you're a Penn State student, if you want to do Ultimate or, I heard that Penn State has a beekeeping club, it doesn't matter. If you get together with people who are different from you and you don't interact with them in terms of some kind of, this is my name online and where there's no accountability, but you actually interact with people face to face, it is much easier to come to understand that we're very similar in terms of what our objectives are for ourselves and our family and what we want out of the world. And it's much harder to hate each other,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you come to see this person as being just like you, fallen, feet of clay, doing the best they can, and not wanting to hurt anybody, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that is one way out, is to find those opportunities. They're out there. And my colleague is in a community band, and she says, well, we just don't talk about it. I know that if something happens, there's going to be 20 hot dishes. There will be food. And, so that is that's one place to start,
yeah.
is just to kind of connect with people outside of politics.
There are many examples in the literature, the anecdotal literature, that show that this sort of thing actually works. One of the best examples is to look at how to push back against science deniers. Jim Bridenstine was a rock-rib Republican member of Congress who gave a speech on the floor of Congress saying all the things that people say against climate change, which he thought it was a hoax, same as the president. And so, of course, President Trump appointed him to be the head of NASA. Within a couple of months, Bridenstine changed his mind publicly and gave a speech saying that he had been wrong, that climate change was real, and that it was caused by humans. Now, what was the difference in those 2 months? He, by becoming head of NASA, he had started to interact on a personal level with the scientists at NASA, see them in the hallway, have lunch with them. So it was no longer just facts and evidence coming at him. It was facts and evidence coming at him from people that he knew personally, that he trusted.
Yeah.
That is the way that you change people's beliefs. That's the way you change them having to do with science. I've got to think that that works for other ideologies as well. There's a terrific book out right now called Rising Out of Hatred about a white nationalist, a white supremacist who changed his mind, rose out of hatred because he was befriended in college by a group of Jewish students who invited him to Shabbat dinner and spoke with him. And after a few months, he changed his mind. We can change our minds through direct personal engagement. I think that's the way we're going to get out of this.
And Christopher, we've got about 15 seconds left here, but echoing what you said before, I feel like we are compelled, we are required as citizens and residents of this country to work hard for our democracy, because
yeah.
if not, what other choice do we have?
I mean, it's just, if you want to play guitar, you're going to have calluses and it's going to hurt. If you want to get in shape, you're going to have to push yourself. And democracy requires the same things of us. It's just, we have to step up to this. It's a better way to be a human being. And we all know that. We just have to behave accordingly.
Well, Christopher Beam is Assistant Research Professor and Managing Director at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. Thank you so much for helping us wrap up this series, Christopher.
My pleasure.
And
really enjoyed it.
And Lee McIntyre, Research Fellow at Boston University Center for Philosophy and the History of Science. It was a pleasure to have you as well. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And folks, this week's series on truth was made possible by all the great producers here at On Point and the editors of TheConversation.com. But let me especially point to Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Maggie Villiger, Emily Costello, Martin LaMonica, and Beth Daly. Go to onpointradio.org for links to the whole series. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.